Welcome, everybody, to a double parsha, our second in a row, Achrei Mos, Kedoshim. Achrei Mos is one parsha, Kedoshim, another parsha. Achrei Mos covers a number of different topics. The first one, which is not identified as such, but it is ultimately the rituals followed in the temple on the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and that occupies a good amount of space of the parsha. And then we move on to some other topics, ultimately coming to the listing of the prohibited marriages and relationships, incest, and so forth. That's mostly of what Achrei Mos is about. And then Kedoshim is one of the parshios that contains many, many, many different commandments. I think I recall that Kedoshim has the most number of commandments of any one single parsha. So it's really hard to give a summation of that. But for example, the famous commandment, "V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha," you shall love your neighbor as yourself, that's found in Kedoshim. And many, many things. Lashon Hara, and many, many things. It's something like over 50. And the Kedoshim is not so long. So you put the two together and you have quite a large and quite a full array of the commandments. In general, Sefer Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, is the book that contains most of the commandments. You know, Bereishis and Shmos are much more story-oriented. Bamidbar is story-oriented. And Devarim is a lot of review and repetition of some of the mitzvot. So Kedoshim, we expect to see a lot of the bulk of the commandments. So Achrei Mos and Kedoshim is a good part of that. Now, let me get oriented here with what we're trying to accomplish this year. We have been studying our Parsha along with the Mesilas Yesharim as a step-by-step guide. We had really just completed this past Tuesday, would have been the completion of the unit on Parishus, separation. Day 40 was Tuesday, but somebody that I studied this with suggested that we extend it a little bit because we had a Pesach break. And so we've decided, the committee on the Mesilas Yesharim of Atlanta has decided to add another 10 days. So we are going to still have another week and maybe one more after this to focus on Parishus, on separation, before moving on to the next virtue. Parishus, we spoke about at length last week. If you recall, Parishus is the power to say no to overindulgence, even of things that are not per se prohibited by the Torah. Parishus is the power to say, I will moderate how I eat, I will moderate my marital activity, I will moderate the clothing I wear, I'll moderate the car I drive, the house I live in, and all the physical material things that people love. And what's the purpose of that? Why would it be a virtue to moderate if it's, as long as a person can afford it and as long as it's not prohibited by the Torah, what's wrong? You know, enjoy life. So we've discussed this in our discussions the past couple of classes. For one thing, Rabbi Luttato warns that if a person is overindulgent, he may not be sinning now, but it may lead him to sin. For example, let's say a person becomes a compulsive eater. So he'll become almost like an addict. And addicts, as we know, become so dependent on the substance that they are addicted to that they will do whatever they have to get it. And that may involve stealing. It may involve dishonesty, breaking down of morals just to you know, to feed his or her habit. And that's an example of how lack of moderation can lead to sin. So that's a practical matter that one needs to learn separation and moderation. Otherwise, it will lead to worse things. Another idea, which we discussed last year, thanks to our CDs, which keep me posted on the class, last class, thanks to Dr. Brickman and his devotion to that project. Rav Yerucham of Mir emphasizes that it's essential while going through life for a Jew to learn the priorities. There's the spiritual, and then there is the material. And we have to learn, we're not born this way, we're born with the understanding that the material is the main thing, but we have to, as we grow and mature Jewishly, we have to start shifting gears and seeing that spiritual is primary and physical should be lessened, the importance of that. And precious, abstinence, separation, is the vehicle to help implement that change, that mind shift. And that's what Rav Yerucham emphasizes. Today I would like to follow that idea and perhaps broaden it a little bit, deepen it a little bit. We're going to read a good bit of what Rabbi Luzzatto says in the final chapter on abstinence and precious, and I would like to also relate it to a few ideas from the Parsha. All right, so let's mention something that I just learned very, very recently, in fact today, about Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is, as I said, the first topic of Acharemos. We know that on Yom Kippur we're not supposed to eat or drink. We have to fast. It's a fast day. And not only eating and drinking, but other things are prohibited as well. Most authorities, they rule that those are rabbinic. But, for example, washing is prohibited, washing for pleasure. I mean, to remove dirt is permissible, but washing for pleasure, anointing for pleasure, wearing shoes is prohibited, marital relations is prohibited, and, of course, eating and drinking.
Leather shoes.
Correct, leather shoes, thank you. That's right. Shoes that contain leather. So, okay, so we think of it, you know, Yom Kippur is a fast day. It's a day of affliction. And that's really what the Torah says. The Torah says, chapter 16, verse 31, Shabbos Shabboson hi lochem ve'in yisem es nafsho sechem chukas olam.
What page is it?
Page 645 in the English. Verse 31, it is a Sabbath of complete rest for you, and you shall afflict yourselves, an eternal decree. It is a Sabbath of complete rest to you, for you, and you shall afflict yourselves, an eternal decree. Now, I don't know how you hear that, but to me that means that Yom Kippur is both a day like Shabbos. It is a day when we do not do any of the forbidden work. Even if it's a weekday, we have to observe all the laws of Shabbos, not the laws of Yom Tov. Therefore, we wouldn't be allowed to do any transferring of fire, any cooking, any carrying. The things that normally are permitted on Yom Tov, that doesn't apply on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, even if it's on a Tuesday, it's just like Shabbos. So, that would explain the first phrase, Shabbos Shabboson hi lochem. It is a Shabbos of complete rest. But also, Yom Kippur has a unique element, and that is the element of the inisem es nafsho sechem. You shall afflict yourselves, which is this prohibition against eating and drinking and the other things. So Yom Kippur is both a Shabbos and also an affliction. Is that how most people understand that, the nature of Yom Kippur? It's like a Shabbos with affliction.
Except the joy of Shabbos, the rest implies relaxing and joyousness, and that's not really what we do on
Yom Kippur.
Or do we?
Well, it would seem, though, if you think about these two elements, the resting and the affliction, that they're almost paradoxical.
Yeah.
Because Shabbos is a day of rest and enjoyment. Yom Kippur, if it's affliction, how can it be Shabbos? How can it be a day of rest if it's a day of affliction? It's a paradox.
Question?
Yes.
When I hear the word rest applying to this, I just equate it with the word cessation. We cease.
We cease.
Yes.
All right, so you're saying rest is a neutral word. It doesn't imply good rest. It doesn't imply bad rest. It just means cessation. Okay, you could say that to resolve the conflict.
That's what Rambam says. Rambam says, or is it Rambam? I'm not sure.
Says what?
Resting from eating and work.
Okay, I was just going to get to that. You read that in here, right?
Yeah.
That's what I learned today, which is a new thought. I didn't know. I'm going to share that with you in just a moment.
Right.
If you say that, then what we have done is we've resolved the paradox, and we've said, oh no, it's a day of denial. Resting means denying. How then would you hear then a quote from Mishnah or a law that says, Lo hayu yamim tovim b'Yisrael, there were no greater days of Yom Tov, that clearly implies Tov, a good day, a holiday. There were no greater holidays for Israel. Kechamisha asar be'av uchiyom hakipurim. Then, no greater than the 15th day of Av. Okay, we never heard of that, but we'll talk about that another time. And Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the greatest holiday, the most elevated, the most joyous, says the Mishnah. Well, if it's a day of affliction, how can it be a great Yom Tov? Sounds more like a day of mourning, a day of sadness, a day of hardship, a day of contrition before God, denial. How can it be a Yom Tov? We need to get our finger on this Yom Kippur. What is it? So, Rabbi Art Scroll, as we like to call him, quotes Rambam, which Linda just referred to, and I had a copy of the English of Rambam. No, I didn't. Okay, let me not belabor that, and let me read to you what it says in the footnote. It is noteworthy that in giving the laws of Yom Kippur, Rambam, Maimonides, does not speak of fasting or affliction. See, he resolves it the other way. You tried to take out, Wendy, or minimize or modify the association with Shabbos. Just call it refrain and underline the association with affliction. Rambam does just the opposite. He doesn't mention the word affliction. He doesn't mention the word fasting. But he says, there is a positive commandment on Yom Kippur to rest from eating and drinking. He almost ignores the word ve'inisem, afflict, and uses the term Shabbos to refer even to the cessation of eating and drinking, which is not what you would expect. So the editor here picks up on that. Rambam's choice of words is significant. He states that on Yom Kippur one rests from the listed activities, which indicates that the purpose of fasting is not that one should suffer, but that he should transcend the normal human limitations that prevent him from functioning properly unless he eats. Normally, we have limitations that prevent us from functioning unless we eat. On Yom Kippur, we rest from that state, and we are able to function without eating. Okay, it sounds semantical, but I'm going to try to come back to this. That's what we're going to try to understand the idea of Yom Kippur. And therefore, Rambam is saying it's all Shabbos. In fact, it's Shabbos Shabbaton. It's more than a regular Shabbos. On Shabbos, we only rest from the work. On Yom Kippur, we rest from the work and from eating and drinking.
Wow.
Like, that's even a better Shabbos. What's going on here? What does this all mean? Okay, put that on hold. Put a little post-it on there and say, come back. All right. To give reference to our second parsha, doubleheader, Kedoshim, one does not have to look far, or one does not have to search to find a connection between Kedoshim and Precious, abstinence. Because the very, very name of the parsha, according to Nachmanides, means Precious. Okay, we've spoken about this probably every year that we've studied the Parshas Kedoshim. On page 656 and 657, Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, Daber el kol adas b'nei Yisrael, speak to the entire assembly of the Jewish people, the Omar Aleihem, say to them, Kedoshim tihiyu, you shall be holy, ki kadosh, ani Hashem elokechem, for holy am I, Hashem, your God. You be holy, because I'm holy. Okay, great. What does that mean, holy? So going straight to Ramban, there's different interpretations, but for our purposes now, the Ramban, very well known, he maintains that the concept of holiness is not limited to the observance of any particular category of commandments. Rather, it is an admonition that one's approach to all aspects of life be governed by moderation, particularly in the area of what is permitted. That's precious. That's exactly what precious is. Precious is abstain and moderate that which is permitted. According to Ramban, that is a mitzvah. Kedoshim tihiyu. Which raises an obvious question. Separation from that which is permitted is, by definition, going beyond the commandment. As Rabbi Lutzato says, it's chassidus, it's piety, which means going beyond. How can it be a mitzvah in the Torah? How can it be a commandment? You are commanded to go beyond the commandment. That's also a paradox. We have so many paradoxes here. How many docs are there here, by the
two.
Way?
Two. We're a paradox.
There are three docs.
No, but we're not a paradox.
Okay. Tridox. Orthodox. Anyway. All right. How can you be commanded to go beyond the commandment? That doesn't sound right. So we're going to come back to that, too. Now, let's get some guidance from Rabbi Lutzato. He tackles in chapter 15 not what abstinence is. He's already explained that. He tackles the question of how does a person motivate himself to acquire abstinence? How does one acquire it? How does a person get himself? It's hard enough to get oneself to do what they're commanded to do. How does one motivate themselves to refrain or withhold from themselves pleasure or enjoyment that is permissible? So, he says, there's definitely a wrong way of going about doing that. There is a difficult way to do that, which is not the recommended way. And then there is the recommended way. The non-recommended way is to pry oneself away from those things that he loves and enjoys. It's not recommended. It's not recommended because, well, it doesn't work very well. Do you remember, I just saw this referenced by Rabbi Tversky in his commentary on the Mesilas Yesharim, Lights Along the Way. And he cites the Greek mythological story of the sirens. You know, the sailors, they go by on the boat and they go through this what is an island, and there's beautiful music.
Sela and Charybdis.
Kolisha.
What is it?
It's Sela and Charybdis.
Is that the name of the poem?
No, it's in the Odyssey.
In the Odyssey.
Odysseus is going through between the rock.
Between the rock, okay.
Sela and Charybdis, the whirlpool. They're the sirens up on the mountain.
Okay.
Calling the sailors, come to me.
There's also a place on the Rhine River. Sounds like Valley High.
That's the Rhine Gold. there. See these girls in the Rhine River that also do that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Kolisha.
Kolisha. So the only way he can keep himself, yeah, it is this, Kolisha. The only thing he can do is tie himself to the mast, right? I mean, you literally have to force yourself to stay away. And that almost doesn't work. So that, he says, is not the recommended way to go about precious. I'll read. The enticement of the eyes, which are tempted by the appearance of things, that seem on page 102, if you'd like to read with me. The enticement of the eyes, which are tempted by the appearance of things that seem good and pleasant, draws one's nature to these pleasures to such an extent that one needs great strength and shrewdness in order to remove himself from their influence. Great strength and shrewdness.
Shrewdness.
You got to be like a superpower to hold yourself back. So, how does one acquire precious? I really read the second paragraph first, so now I'll start again with the first paragraph. The ideal way for a person to acquire abstinence is to examine the inferior nature of the pleasures of this world, their insignificance, and the serious ills that are likely to emerge from them. Okay, I'm not here on a rampage, you know, down with the world. I love this world, as we all do. But let's read on. It was an enticement. It was this enticement of the eyes that he mentioned in the second paragraph. I'm skipping out to the third paragraph. It was this enticement that caused the first sin to be committed, as the verse testifies in Bereshis 3:6. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat. It was desirable to the eyes. And the tree was also attractive as a means to gain intelligence. So she took some of its fruit and ate it. So it started with an enticement. It started with an invitation, which was broadcast, or which was funneled through the eyes. So the eyes have this power of enticing. Yet, when a person discerns that this, quote, good is totally false, illusory, and without any permanence, and the evil in it is real or imminently about to emerge from it, then surely he will loathe it and reject it totally.
Totally.
If it's bad for you, what if a person loves to smoke? So he's enticed. He loves it. It's an enjoyment. It's a pleasure. Can't say no. But what if the person came to the realization that it's poison? It's killing me. The next smoke might do me in. If a person really had that clarity, would the person truly long for it or yearn for it? He says not. He says it will be. He says it will not be attractive. The question is the person still living with the enticement, or have they gotten over the enticement? Have they gotten over the illusion? The false illusion? Or are they still living under the illusion? This then, so now getting back to the method, how does one acquire abstinence? It doesn't start with a restraint. It doesn't start with a forceful denial against a person's will. That will not work. That should never come into the play. It should never be a forced thing. What has to happen is something maybe a little bit more profound, a shift in mental association with the pleasure. This then is the entire lesson that one must teach himself, to recognize the flimsy nature of these pleasures and their falseness.
This is the Rambam.
This is Rabbi Luzzatto. Rabbi Luzzatto. Until he instinctively comes to loathe them and will find no difficulty in casting them out. And again, my initial reaction when I hear this is, you're so negative. Gosh, what a party pooper. You know, pleasure is pleasure. He goes further. The example of eating. Although the pleasure of eating, for example, is the most sensory and stimulating of all pleasures, is there anything more perishable and more quickly lost than food? The span of time of its entry into the body is no more than the time it takes to pass through the esophagus. Once it leaves that area and enters the intestines, it is gone and forgotten, as though it had never existed. Now, we need to eat to be healthy. We need to eat to be satiated. And that's something that stays with you. However, eating coarse bread, if one were to eat enough, could satiate him the same way eating fattened geese does. The truth of this lesson becomes even more apparent when one considers the many disorders that one might contract through eating, or at least the heaviness that one feels after meals and the vapors that becloud his brain. Surely then, with all this in mind, a person will not want such a thing, since its good is not beneficial and its bad is harmful. If we don't agree with this, it's only because we are not clear on the enticement thing. We're still enticed. And that's fine. That's how God made us. But it is an enticement. A person, we all know, something. A person can experience something that will totally remove that desire. It could be something else happens, which is much more pressing, and all of a sudden he loses the appetite. It could be discovering somehow that it's bad for him. And we see that this, what seems so real and seems so strong and beckoning, could banish. This is the way God created us, with this enticement, and the first person to experience it was none other than Eve.
Another paradox. By negating the pleasure, it's no longer pleasure. How is it abstinence from a pleasure at that point?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good.
He said if you negate it, it'll look like...
Okay, I heard this, that last week we had the nega, the affliction, you know.
Yeah.
And we have the oneg, and they are spelled there. It's an anagram. It depends on where the ion is, and the ion is...
Is the I. Oh, beautiful.
So that's
beautiful.
Nice.
In other words, Perry is saying that the Hebrew word for nega, which is afflictions, last week, and remember, our message last week is that God sends these afflictions, the taras, to our bodies, to our clothing, and to our homes when we abuse them. This is not a standard interpretation, but something which I learned once. A lack of abstinence. Now, nega is nun gimel ayin. If you take the ayin and put it back at the beginning, you have oneg, which means pleasure or delight.
Right.
So the ayin is the swing letter, and ayin means I. So the I is the arbiter of whether it is a pleasure or whether it's an affliction. Interesting. Very, very beautiful. Okay. So Rabbi Luzzatto says that, and this is something that I don't think it would occur to someone, if they would want to be abstinent, they would kind of like force themselves to do it. They would just like, you know, bite the bullet and say, I gotta do this. And he's saying that's not the way to do it. It's up here. It's a mindset. Yeah.
The forcing oneself not to is so different than seeing the bad result. Now, if you have some positive goal by which you can abstain,
right,
whereas the other is just...
It should be a motivation. It should be a pleasure abstaining. He says that. He says that, when one accustoms himself to this truth and analyzes it with diligence, he will slowly be freed, and that was our class last week, this is real freedom, from the stultifying imprisonment which the corporeal world has imposed on him, and he will no longer be enticed by pseudo-enjoyments. He will then loathe them, and he will become aware that he should take from this world only what is essential, as I have written. But he says elsewhere that it will not be difficult. It will not be difficult. Again, that's why you have to work up. I mean, you don't go straight to Parishas, remember? Torah, Zihirus, Rizus, Nikius, Parishas. But it's a development of the mind and of the attitudes.
Rabbi, most change comes from illness.
Mm-hmm.
When you are awakened with an epiphany that if you don't change, you'll die. Diabetes, hopefully, you'll change your diet. Hypertension, heart disease, cancer. I mean, you can tell people to stop smoking, they never will.
Yeah.
And then you say, all right, I found your first cancerous lymph node.
Yeah. Yeah.
They stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
So that the change, the change, the mental shift,
can
occur suddenly when you get it.
Yeah,
and it's the same principle as the steps that you're talking about.
Yeah, very good.
When you get up here, you get it. But if I'm shocked at my own physical health or a loved one, I get it then.
The foolishness of humanity is that we don't learn the lesson from all of the people that came before us. You know, it's not enough that it happened to your neighbor or happened to your grandfather or your uncle. You got to wait until Chas v'Shalom, it's right at your doorstep. You know, it's take the lesson.
And then you have the smoker who says, my father is still smoking at 84.
Right, right.
Look how long he could have lived.
Right. That's right. Part of the enticement. God throws in a few of those too sometimes to help the enticement. Yes.
Let me throw one. This is Shakespeare. Had a little couplet that says, all this the world knows well, but none know yet to shun this heaven that leads men to this hell.
Wow.
That's one of his sonnets.
Very good.
It's lust in action.
Yasher Koach Shakespeare. Very nice. Thank you. Okay. So, let me share with you a fascinating conversation that I had with a young man this week. 15-year-old young man, very, very limited background of Torah, anything. And he wanted to meet with a rabbi and talk about the Jewish view on life and death and the afterlife. So I had a conversation with him. I wanted to explain it. And by the way, thank you all for giving me this opportunity to develop these ideas with you, because it is this material that we have shared together that enabled me to speak with this young man. I asked him to describe his greatest pleasure. So he said, can you define that? And I said, I asked you first. So we came to the decision that there's two kinds of pleasures. I kind of fed him this. I said, what's your favorite food? And he said, Mexican. I said, I knew he was an athlete. I said, what's your sport? Tennis. Have you ever won a match? Sure, many of them. How does it feel? Great. I said, which is more pleasurable? The Mexican food or winning the tennis match? He says, the tennis match. I said, why? He says, because the Mexican food, all I did was pay $10. I didn't earn much. It just came to me. Whereas the tennis, I worked really hard at it. Aha. Very good. So now we have defined two kinds of pleasure. Pleasure that comes to you easy, without really earning it, and pleasure of accomplishment, of striving and achieving something. Good. Then I said to him, how many matches have you won? He says, oh, many. I said, so do you get the, do you have the feeling of what it's like to win all of those all at once? He says, no. I said, it's impossible. I said, why is that impossible? He says, I mean, they happen one at a time. So I said, you're right, because we're living here in a body, and we live in the confines of time, and we can only live one moment at a time, no matter what we do. And we have forgetfulness. We can experience something 1 minute, and then it'll fade, and we will forget it. So you can only feel the pleasure of that victory while it's happening. I said, what if I told you that you could experience the pleasure of all of your victories all at once? He says, wow. I says, well, you can, but you're going to have to get out of your body first, and you're going to have to get out of time. You're going to have to go somewhere where there are no constraints of time. He says, really, where is that? I said, well, that's after we die. After we die, we leave our bodies, and then we can experience everything that we've, all the pleasures that we've ever accomplished at once. He says, wow. So then I said to him, well, why do you think people are afraid of dying then?
Not all.
So he gave, well, okay, most of us. He gave the standard answer, which is correct. He says, because we don't know what it's going to be like, the fear of the unknown. I said, okay. But that's fair. I said, based on our conversation today, can you think of another answer? So he says, I'm taking a little bit of liberty. He says, will I be able to experience all the pleasure of all the Mexican burritos that I've had all at once too? And I said, oh, no. I forgot to tell you.
All that gas.
After we die, we don't experience the pleasure of the burritos, only the pleasure of the tennis matches. In other words, we only experience the pleasure that we worked for, not the pleasures that came to us with little effort. So he said, aha. So the reason why people would be afraid of dying is because they've eaten so many burritos and haven't won very many tennis matches. So when they get out of their physical constraints, they're not going to have any pleasure. That was a very, very interesting. This guy says, I get it.
And that's why if you abstain from food, it'll be like you die. You come out on the other side and you'll be free.
But what happens if we're not eating, but we're not accomplishing either?
Oh.
And we get on the other side?
Why aren't we accomplishing?
Ah, that's a great question. So pleasure after life comes when we have accomplished something during life and we have something to experience on the other side.
Okay.
But in order to accomplish, we have to stop eating so many burritos.
Exactly.
Because burritos seem pleasurable and accomplishment seems pleasurable. But burritos seems a little bit more immediately pleasurable than accomplishment, because accomplishment takes time and hard work.
So you just set up a finish line?
So coming back to Parishas, let us just broaden this concept again. The purpose of Parishas then is to, because we're created with this enticement that we've got the sign that says, you know, eat burritos, and there's also the sign that says accomplish things that you can take with you, and the burrito sign is a lot more enticing, and we realize that if we just follow our eyes, we're going to be left with holding very little at the end. That is the importance of precious. The importance of precious is to get it straight and get the true vision clear, that what we should be doing here is spending our time accomplishing things. And I would like to suggest that this is how the Rambam views Yom Kippur. He doesn't view Yom Kippur as a day of affliction. He views Yom Kippur as a day where the enticements are gone. It's a day of rest. Just like we rest from all the toil and labor that we do, the 39 forbidden labors that weary us so. We also get to rest from the enticements of the food and the drink, which so distract us from seeing the clarity of what's really important, what's really pleasurable in life, and that is to take our accomplishments with us. And we don't have to look far because we're given the formula, our Torah. That is God has given us our ticket to the ultimate pleasure. It's all in the Torah, in the study and the observance of Torah. We are forming a bond with God. That is the pleasure. That is the eternal pleasure and the greatest one. So Yom Kippur is one day a year where we get to be free of the enticement. And that is... Now, I just would like to say that Yom Kippur is not for every day. In fact, we're not supposed to live Yom Kippur all the time. If we can somehow get on the Torah track, guess what? The Torah will instruct us and guide us how we can even turn physical life, pleasurable physical life, into accomplishment. That is the beauty of Torah. Torah says, use your entire being. Participate. Participate and enjoy life according to the guidelines of the Torah, and then even your physical pleasures will be mitzvahs, will be spiritual take-home accomplishments. If you enjoy Shabbos and you delight in the Shabbos food, you will be earning mitzvahs. If you engage in family life, healthy, kosher family life, you will be taking home mitzvahs. And on and on. That is the Torah. So Yom Kippur is an easy day because we see clearly when we take away all physical things. But that's once a year. All year it's Torah guides us through the physical world. And that is, going back to the Kedoshim Tihiyu, the question we raised was, hey, if Kedoshim means be abstinent from permissible things, how can it be a mitzvah? How can it be a commandment to go beyond the commandment? And the answer is this. Specifically, it's not. It is not specifically you must refrain from that amount of pleasure. No, God sets limits with the commandments. Beyond that, it is not prescribed. There is no specific commandment abstain from X, Y, or Z, assuming it's permissible. But there is a commandment to try to get the true picture here. Jew, make sure that you don't go through life just looking at the enticements. Make sure that you strive for separation. Make sure that you strive for seeing this world as an opportunity to accomplish and not as an opportunity to eat burritos, even if they're kosher burritos. I'm commanding you to develop on the mindset that Rabbi Luzzatto is talking about, that you cannot compromise on. Even though I'm not giving you any specific limitations or moderations, that's for you to choose on your level, at your time, but make sure that you strive to be Kedoshim. Make sure that your goal in life is to win tennis matches and not eat burritos. At some point and sometime, that is a commandment. And I think that gives us, a little more satisfaction here with the importance of abstinence. It's not just a, you know, when you read it, abstinence, oh, it's so extreme, and it's like a monk and all that. It's enough that we, you know, do the commandments, don't bother me. No, this is much more central. This is a mitzvah, kadoshim tiyu, strive for holiness, which means strive to see the truth and avoid going through life with an illusion. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.